TV shows like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire should not surprise us. The get-rich-fast fantasy has always existed. And we're bombarded with these images and these messages, not only through our televisions. We only have to send our child to school to read classics like Jane Austen novels, where the theme of salvation appears in financial terms. The impoverished young woman is saved by the wealthy groom. And this is not just in her literature, but is a part of her world context, that in her day, Great Britain was reaping the spoils of colonialism, that in this world, the rich churches posed as saviors for the poorer churches, as if in some sort of parent-child relationship, some sort of groom-bride relationship. So it's not just as if financial salvation is some separate secular world, but this type of rhetoric is integrated into the very fabric of our religion. Just as Jane Austen was bound by her context, so is the letter to Timothy. Verse 3, if anyone teaches a different doctrine and does not agree with the sound words of our Lord Jesus Christ, that person understands nothing. Now, this is not directly related to the topic of money, but more explicitly related to the topic of false prophets. But false prophets are often associated with wealth. And in Timothy's context, there is a lot of wealth. And in particular, there are a lot of wealthy women. And we know there's a lot of wealthy women converting to Christianity. We know this because the Bible lists many as patrons. And in these instances, it's very positive. There's no problem with wealth because they're spending it for the greater good. But what is slightly different to this particular circle is that the women were not just wealthy. We know that there were wealthy women who were also famous oracle tellers. And these women were sought out far and wide for their wisdom. And when these women converted to Christianity, they presumed that their elite status as a spiritual leader automatically crossed over into their Christian life, that they were automatically authoritative without any sort of training, without any sort of seminary formation. And so this really irks, you know, the writer of Timothy, that these women, not only are they saying all of these things and being presumptuous, but they wear gold and they wear pearls, which then leads Timothy to ban wearing gold and pearls. And these women have the audacity to braid their hair. Whoops. Which he also forbids. And so when Timothy earlier in his letter says, "Women, do not preach," I urge you to read this in light of this context, in light of the context where Timothy is also warning leaders, religious leaders, to not be young in their faith. Do not be green. Do not be a greenhorn, but have mature faith. So it's a matter of false prophets and true prophets. And we see Timothy noticing, perceiving that there's some sort of correlation with these women's outer appearance and the deep-seated issues that they have. And so in this letter, there's a conclusion that money is indeed the root of all kinds of evils. Why are these women using holiness as a means for financial gain? Why is spiritual teaching at a price? And this rubs up against our modern culture today with how we live out and practice church. So, for some reason, this type of inter-religious mixing that the women are a part of with these oracles, Timothy's saying there's something suspicious about that. But this is not to say that Timothy has something against finding truth in other religions. In fact, in the Greek text, the very words that show up again and again and again are the predominant vocabulary used in other traditions like Stoic faith and cynicism. And so these are alternatives to Christianity, and yet Timothy can still say, yeah, I endorse and share the aspirations of this other group, this group to live modestly. So when I see this tension of how do we view ourselves and how do we look at other religions, you know, we have to be careful. There's a tremendous amount of thoughtful discernment because there are false prophets. This is not an anything goes kind of religion. And so it's our responsibility to figure out where are the false prophets today. Upon death, the rich man in the Gospel of Luke wants to send a message to his family. He wants to send the message for them to heed the true prophets. And to this request, Abraham denies it, and he gives his reason. You know, look, if they're not going to listen to Moses, how is a resuscitated Lazarus going to convince them? And the interesting thing is, the rich man is in Hades, aka he knows there is an afterlife. He is conversing with the Abraham, and he sees Lazarus among the angels, and he still doesn't even get it. He doesn't get it because even after death, even after all that is revealed to him, he still treats Lazarus like a slave. Tell Lazarus to do this. Tell Lazarus to bring me water. Send him the message. It's like you have lost all of your friends and you still haven't looked at yourself and asked, was it you? Are you the common denominator? You have encountered everlasting truth, but your body, your character, your very core is still governed by false prophets. The rich man is still living according to the false prophet of Mammon. He may not have brought his treasures into the afterlife, but he looks at Lazarus and he sees him as the available currency. I'm not saying that Lazarus was a slave on earth, but he is being treated as a commodity. His body is treated as a commodity. So the rich man is still operating in this realm of commerce. And yet there's this ironic reversal that Lazarus, who is among the least free in society, among the least of society, is now the rich man's source and hope of liberation. The unfree person frees. This is the new economy. So it's not that we're abandoning economic language from our religion. You know, the Bible is not promising salvation to financial wealth, but the Bible still uses financial terms to describe salvation. One of our founding fathers from the 4th century, Bishop and Saint Gregory of Nyssa, who, by the way, made significant contributions to the doctrine of the Trinity and to the Nicene Creed, he portrays Jesus as divine currency. Jesus' body, in a similar way to Lazarus, his body was commodified, and he becomes the center of a crucial economic transaction that affects redemption. That Jesus' body paid the price, and that was the ransom for freeing all of creation. God is the spiritual broker. There is risk and there is investment. And we do not leave these terms behind. So, as I was explaining this, talking about this on an interfaith panel, one of the Hindu-Buddhist representatives says, okay, well, so what you're saying is that God is like a pimp and that Jesus is like a prostitute. Because what you're saying is that in the same way a young girl is sold into sex trafficking by her father, by her very family, in order to bring economic relief for the many, Jesus' body is being used in this way by his father. And this totally blew me away, that I had never looked at how Jesus as being a ransom, as paying my bail, could be seen like this. And so that's why it's important to think and reflect upon how we're viewed from outside, whatever outside is. And we have to respond and we have to prepare ourselves. And that's why we do things like formation hour and we toil and we labor tirelessly to read the Bible so that we know where the false prophets are and that we don't become false prophets, that we don't offer people an uncritical view of salvation. So this doesn't necessarily sound neat and tidy either. If God is not a pimp, how do we talk about Gregory and Timothy's economic view of Jesus as a ransom, as someone who pays our bail out of the devil's grasp or whatever hold that we're bound by? And so might we look at this as if God didn't do this, that the Father didn't do this to his Son, but that God chose to empty themselves from divine wealth into human poverty. And in this mask was able to offer some sort of counterfeit currency, that through the incarnation, the true extent of divine power is clouded, that the devil actually sees this unassuming man, this fully human man, and intellectually acknowledges, you know, this person is divine, is fully divine, but is totally caught off guard and actually thinks that he can contain God, that he can actually imprison Jesus. And so in this way, maybe Jesus is the camouflaged trickster who makes stealth investment in order to explode the diabolic bank. I'm going with it. In other words, the divine advertising strategy has successfully attracted the intended buyer, and the divine business reputation is left intact. And so the deity veiled as a human was able to penetrate the devil's realm, fraud, and surprise. Now, this Jesus sort of looks like a Robin Hood figure of sorts, and that complicates things. Do the ends really justify the means? Is that what we're saying here? This doesn't sound like a Jesus I could easily imitate. And yet, something wants to hold on to this idea of the trickster God that we saw last week with the shrewd manager, that God is cunning, wise as a serpent, even though gentle as a dove. And so I feel like I'm watching these mob movies or some other morally ambiguous story with gamblers and gangsters where I secretly admire them and sympathize. And then other times I just want to separate myself and revel in my own middle-class anonymity and point fingers at the con artists. But really, I'm complicit at all levels, and I succumb to the same consumeristic ideals as the supposedly greedier people. I even craft, tell myself these wonderfully sound biblical excuses. You know, fact, creation is good. Fact, the incarnation does affirm and bless materiality. In fact, our church says that paying attention to clothing is not so bad, and actually it can be a lens to see God more closely. But I know deep inside when I've crossed a line. And we all have these lines, and they're blurry, and they're porous, and we will all spend the entirety of our lives wrestling with the ambiguity. And we will wrestle because we refuse to be reductionist. This is precisely why we need a trickster side of God. That in the same way that a medieval royal court has a jester, a royal fool who can say it like it is to the king's face and not get beheaded, who in all of his frivolity and foolishness is actually the wisest and most courageous of all, the one who can actually cut through and crack open the status quo. And we need this trickster God to teach me when a braid is more than just a braid. And the trickster God helps us discern when a company is sincerely green and environmentally careful and responsible versus when a company uses greenwashing maneuvers to serve capitalism. And we need the trickster God to separate the wealthy female patrons from the wealthy female oracle tellers, to separate trickery from perfidy, to separate money from the God of mammon, to separate the idea of Jesus as a ransom from the borderline vulgar idea that Jesus could be a prostitute, to separate truth in other religions from just sheer manipulation, false prophets from true prophets. Perhaps Jesus as a ransom is not how you experience God, but it is how Timothy, the author of Timothy, experienced God. The author of Timothy knew God as a criminal, experienced being bailed out of jail for the worst possible crimes. And this language is here. We conserve it. We are conservative in that we keep these words, because we know that this writer is bound by language too, that somehow it must be articulated what God does in our lives, that God makes a difference. And so perhaps we don't resonate with that financial terminology, and maybe we do. But we have to consider the cost of our language. And we have to be able to sift through all of the alluring promises of hopes and all of the deception, and figure out how we are going to articulate everlasting salvation in God.